This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 302,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally, and the number of confirmed infections has surpassed 4.4 million globally. In the United States, approximately 86,000 people have died, and the number of infections is more than 1.4 million. U.S. President Donald Trump says he intends to prepare the country for future pandemics by restocking the national stockpile. He says that includes bringing critical manufacturing back to the U.S. from abroad. Mr. Trump announced his plans Thursday while visiting a Pennsylvania medical equipment distributor. His comments came the same day a whistleblower testified that the Trump administration had failed to properly prepare for the current pandemic. Trump is also trying to convince the public that it's time for states to begin to reopen, even as the virus continues to spread. He called on Pennsylvania's Democratic governor to open up the state. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning doctors about a rare but serious condition in children linked with coronavirus. In an alert issued Thursday, the CDC called the condition multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. Over 100 children in New York and several other states have been sickened. It was first reported several weeks ago in Europe. A few deaths have occurred. The CDC says symptoms include a fever, severe illness requiring hospitalization, and inflammatory markers in the blood. Most affected children have had current or recent coronavirus infections. U.S. health officials have released part of some long-delayed specific guidance that schools, businesses, and other organizations can use as states reopen from coronavirus shutdowns. The Centers for Disease Control posted a set of six decision tools documents. The one-page document, you use traffic signs and other graphics to tell organizations what to do. This is VOA News. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is criticizing Republicans for seeking to delay the next round of economic relief. 2 days after Pelosi unveiled a new $3 trillion plan, the White House threatened that President Trump would veto that measure. It was a symbolic threat because opposition by Senate Republicans, led by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, means a Democratic bill would never reach Mr. Trump. But the day's exchanges emphasized the election year partisan divide over the effort. The Democratic proposal is the first step in what seems likely to result in negotiations among congressional leaders and the White House. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is lifting a coronavirus state of emergency ahead of all scheduled in most of the country, except for 8 high-risk areas. Abe is lifting the measure in 39 of the country's 47 prefectures. It remains in effect in Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, and four other prefectures. The state of emergency was due to continue until the end of May. Abe says experts will meet next week to decide if the measures can be lifted in the remaining areas. The state of emergency gives local leaders the legal basis to request social distancing measures but does not impose penalties. Mental health experts are warning that as the world pandemic drags on, the mounting combination of death, joblessness, and uncertainty is also fueling a mental health crisis. The WHO is asking governments to put the issue front and center. It's a depressing combination, of course, and the United Nations is asking the governors, as the pandemic crisis drags on, not to forget that mental health toll that this is having on many people. The WHO's report released Thursday also shows high levels of distress in the United States. General population, about 45% of those surveyed. Children and frontline workers, they say, are among the most vulnerable groups. Reuters has itself met many doctors and nurses across the world experiencing combinations of panic, grief, and nightmares. The WHO did outline steps that governments can take to help ease the burden. The United Nations is forecasting that the coronavirus pandemic will shrink the world economy by 3.2% this year. That's the sharpest contraction since the Great Depression in the 1930s. The UN's mid-year report released Wednesday said COVID-19 is expected to slash global economic output by nearly $8.5 trillion over the next 2 years, wiping out nearly all gains of the last 4 years. In January, the UN forecast a modest growth of 2.5% in 2020. The report said the pandemic is also likely to push an estimated 34.3 million people below the extreme poverty line in 2020. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's Election Commission Chair, Jean Ansah, says her commission does not have the power to decide election dates.
The responsibility of MEC is to discharge its mandate of managing elections on a date appointed by Parliament.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari names a veteran diplomat and economist as his chief of staff. Today, Friday, is International Day of Families, and we'll tell you about families in Uganda. And the World Food Program says millions of Africans will suffer from hunger and malnutrition this year due to COVID-19.
This is an urgent issue, as more than 200 million people are undernourished in the WHO African region, and the pandemic is making the hunger situation worse.
And a New Yorker with Liberian roots is in this Sunday's finale of the American Idol singing competition. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's Electoral Commission Chairperson, Jean Ansah, says her commission does not have the mandate to decide election dates. She says that privilege is reserved for the Malawi Parliament. Ansah says the Elections Commission's responsibility is to manage elections on the dates chosen by Parliament. This after it was reported that the commission, also known as MEC, had proposed to Parliament to change the date of the court-ordered special presidential election from July 2nd to June 23rd this year. Justice Ansah says the June 23rd date is in line with the Supreme Court ruling, which, while annulling the 2019 election results, mandated that fresh elections be held within 150 days from February 3rd to 2020.
It is not the commission that is changing the date. The 23rd of June was just mentioned as a tentative date following the judgment of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has upheld the High Court's judgment, and in particular the order that fresh elections should be conducted within 150 days from 3rd February 2020. Now, the 2nd July is the 149th day, which is within the 150 days. But the Supreme Court has elaborated on the 150 days that it should include the 8 days of processing the results. To include the 8 days processing days, we counted backward. And counting backwards, it gives us 23rd June, according to the judgment of the Supreme Court. That said, it was clearly said that MEC does not have the mandate to set a date for polling.
Has the commission already submitted a proposal to the parliament to consider changing the election date from July 2nd to June 23rd? If not, who is supposed to come up with that proposal for parliament to consider?
As I said, the commission has not changed any date at all. The Supreme Court judgment has clearly said that the responsibility of deciding a date for election is with the parliament and not MEC. I believe the registrar will have to communicate to parliament, because a parliament complied with the High Court orders without MEC doing anything at all. I'm sure there must be a procedure that is followed by the court in communicating its orders to Parliament. I repeat, the Commission has not changed any date. It is very, very clear that the Electoral Commission cannot decide on the date for polling. As I said earlier on, the date for polling of elections is contained in the Constitution, and it's only the Parliament that can amend the Constitution using the usual procedures, not MEC.
Suppose Parliament does not change the date to June 23rd. Will the Commission be able to have the election on July 2nd?
The most important thing to know is that MEC does not have any mandate to decide the date of election. Whatever date Parliament comes up with, MEC is there to have the election on the date Parliament has chosen. So the choice of a date is not the responsibility of MEC. The responsibility of MEC is to discharge its mandate of managing elections on a date appointed by Parliament.
Justice Jane Ansah is the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has named Professor Ibrahim Gambari as his new chief of staff. Gambari is a scholar, diplomat, and a former prominent representative of Nigeria to the United Nations. He also served as Minister for External Affairs and a former UN Undersecretary General and Special Advisor to the Secretary General on Africa. Gambari's appointment has received wide accolades. For analysis on Professor Gambari's appointment, VOA's Peter Clutter spoke with economist Chudi Chukwani.
Yes, basically, yesterday, the president presented the new chief of staff to the Nigerian public. And I believe his name is Professor Gambari. From the little we know of him, he was running a small consulting outfit here in Abuja. And from what is in the public space, nothing that anybody can point that consulting firm has done. In our constitution, a chief of staff is just akin like an errand boy or a domestic staff to the president. There's no constitutional creation in our constitution for his chief of staff. So all he does is to deliver messages and pass messages up and down from the presidency. So we are hoping to see what type of messages he delivers to the president. And in terms of policy, he has no say in any policy as far as our constitution is concerned. So let's see what happens.
Chudi, Professor Gambari said he will serve the president to the best of his ability when he was presented to Nigerians. However, he is being praised by a lot of people, including the former vice president, Atiku Abubakar, as a masterstroke of an appointment by the president. How are Nigerians reacting to his appointment?
Basically, to the ordinary Nigerian on the street, nobody actually knows anything about Professor Gambari. It's just what the little bit we have read in the newspaper. The Nigerians that are praising him are probably those that are interested in delivering some form of message to the president. And since Professor Gambari is now the conduit to deliver messages to the president, they are praising him in the hope that whatever messages that they want delivered to the president by Professor Gambari will be delivered. And whatever responses that they want from the president will be the response that the president gives. So that is what is forming all this praising and talking. There's really nothing policy-wise that Professor Gambari is there to do, apart from delivering messages.
In 2005, the Sahara Reporters, a Nigerian-centered newspaper online, wrote an article about Professor Gambari that was not flattering at all, even though the article said that he is a consummate diplomat who represented Nigeria well at the United Nations. What is your take about this article, and will this reflect poorly on him in your view?
Not really. Number one, Sahara Reporter gossip is akin to like the Sun or the Post in America. So it's just a gossip, pay for hire, you know, online article. Mind you, during the regime of President Goodluck Jonathan, the same Sahara Report was in league with the APC. He was doing the bidding of APC and was publishing all manners of articles that was detrimental to the regime of Jonathan in that time. So Sahara Reporters is just a gossip. I've read the article from the... He doesn't really know anything what happened. I mean, there was a serious issue. The trial of the Ken Sarawiwa
and the other Ogoni things was not a kangaroo at all. In actual fact, they killed the Ogoni chiefs and they were tried according to the laws of Nigeria. And Adari was the representative in the United Nations and he was representing Nigeria. And he had to represent Nigeria to the best of his ability. So, you know, I don't pay any mind to Sahara reporters. They are completely uninformed. It's just a gossip columnist. That's the only way I can describe them.
That was Nigerian economist Chudi Chukwani speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 15th. At least 200 million Africans will suffer from hunger and malnutrition by December this year. The World Food Program estimates that millions of children below the age of 5 will be the most affected if the COVID-19 pandemic continues. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the World Health Organization is asking countries to adhere to the COVID-19 measures to slow the spread of the virus.
As COVID-19 continues to spread in sub-Saharan Africa, the World Food Program says food production will be affected in many countries. Chris Nikoi, Regional Director, World Food Program, West and Central Africa, said that more than 135 million people may not be in a position to feed themselves if the respective governments will not manage the spread of the virus.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, hunger was already a real concern for many people in many parts of the African continent. Another 135 million globally could be added on who may be at the risk of not being able to feed themselves if something is not done.
Trade and transportation of food at the border points in most African countries is at standstill, as most countries are cautious of people coming in from other countries spreading the virus. Mr. Nikoi said, World Food Program is working with ECOWAS member states to have smooth movement of food and essential goods. He warns this year, more than 12 million children between the age of 6 months to 5 years will suffer from malnutrition.
We are trying to provide policy advice that ECOWAS countries across the board will be encouraged to adopt so that food flows much, much more smoothly. And I hope that in Eastern Africa, they will also be looking at similar measures.
On the other hand, Dr. Mashidiso Moet, World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, said that undernourished people are at risk of contracting COVID-19 virus since they have weak immune system.
This is an urgent issue, as more than 200 million people are undernourished in the WHO African region, and the pandemic is making the hunger situation worse. Undernourished people have weaker immune systems and may be at greater risk of severe illness if infected. On the other side, we also know that obesity and diabetes are linked to a higher risk of hospitalization and death related to COVID-19.
According to WHO, more than 72,000 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed, with additional 2,500 deaths reported, affecting 47 countries out of 54 in the African continent. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today is International Day of Families, which promotes awareness of issues relating to families. Officials in Uganda say families have contributed greatly in helping people to stay together during the difficult days of the coronavirus lockdown. But they say cases of gender-based violence and child abuse have also been increasing during the pandemic. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi reports from Kampala, Uganda.
The theme of this year's International Day of Family is Harmonious Family, a Key to Sustainable Peace and Development. Peace Regis Mutuzo, Uganda's Minister of State for Gender and Culture Affairs, says the existence of family structures in Uganda has helped in containing the spread of COVID-19 pandemic, as people have homes to rely on during the difficult times of the lockdown. Mutuzo says the family cannot be strong if there is violence.
The family is the first place where we receive our first education and where socialization of values and other traits are learned. Although most families are living harmoniously and peacefully, there are some families that have become very violent, especially within this time where we need families most to fight against COVID and to develop respectful citizens.
She says there has been a spike in rates of gender-based violence and violence against children since this year began. In just 4 months alone, from January to April this year, cases of violence against children were 1,967, more than 50% of such cases that were reported in the whole of last year. Most of this violence were committed against girl children, sometimes by people supposed to protect them.
Gender-based violence figures reported were 3,280 within a period of less than 1 month, between the 30th of March to the 28th of April 2020. I am concerned with such huge figures for children and women. Some members of the family have died due to intolerance at home, and this is unacceptable.
Caro Mukisa is the head of Warm Hearts Foundation, a local NGO that advocates for women and children's rights. She says, unfortunately, most of these crimes are sometimes not reported to police.
So many partners have been battering their counterparts, and one of the reasons is that during this lockdown, they are kept indoors and they are not able to escape from their partners. And even those ones who are tortured cannot be able to report the cases because most of the offices are closed. Some children are getting filed from their parents, from their caretakers. And this has been hiked because these kids sometimes would use school as an escape, but now they cannot go to school. So they are kept and forced indoors with the tormentors.
Minister Mutuzo says once the lockdown is lifted and the country is declared free from COVID-19, her ministry will track and punish the offenders. She's also calling on the public to report to police and local authorities cases of gender-based violence and violence against children. As the world struggles to respond to the COVID-19 crisis, the United Nations reports that the diminishing number of extended families and the increasing number of single-parent families puts into a sharp focus the issue of social protection. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
This Sunday is the finale of the American Idol singing competition on ABC television here in the United States. A 21-year-old New York young lady with Liberian roots is one of the contestants. Her name is Samantha, a.k.a. Just Sam Diaz. She has a big fan base. And here to tell us about Samantha or Just Sam and how people can vote for her is Glendy Reeves of Virginia, USA.
She started singing as far back as when she was in the seventh grade. She used to go and sing at her parents' job where her dad and her mom used to work. And because there were so many challenges with them financially, they decided that they would continue to do the singing because it brought them some income, and then they could help their grandmother. From early morning to late evening, she said some days she made $25, $50. Some days on the train, she would ride from place to place on the train, she'd make $100, and she would take the money to her grandmother to be able to assist with their needs. Her grandmother is a Liberian. Her name is Elizabeth, and Elizabeth comes from Maryland County in Liberia. One of the things that have attracted us to the Justin story is this is somebody who did not allow their story to determine their next move or her situation to determine how her soul will be rating tomorrow. She continued to sing, and finally she was able to contest in the American Idol.
What day is she going to come out?
This Sunday is the last episode. The significance in this is right now we have the top seven, and Just Sam happens to be the second person in the top seven. We voted last Sunday. The results from last Sunday votes will be announced at the beginning of the show this Sunday. So we will know from the top seven, we will know who the top five is. And then during the live program, we will now vote from the top five to find out who the top three, I believe, or top two. And then from there, we're going to go to who the winner is. So the show is going to end on Sunday, and we're looking forward to again because it's a competition. It's vote day. You who have the most votes is going to be the one who's going to win it. And so that's what that is.
So you have a website.
We have a Facebook page, yeah.
Uh-huh. So what would you want to tell people who will be listening in terms of what they should be doing?
There are three ways you can vote. The first way you can vote is to vote for Justin. Her number is number 19. You can text her number 19 on your phone to 21523. You text your number 19 to 21523. you're going to text 19 10 times. The second time you can vote by downloading the American Idol app. Once you download the app, you're going to also look for her picture. You're going to find her picture and you're going to add it 10 times. So that's 10 plus 10 equals 20. The last time you can vote is by going to www.americanidol.com and creating an account. Once you go to that account, you can also go there and look for just Sam's picture, add it 10 times, and then you get an additional 10 and 30. Each person can get a total of 30 votes.
Can people in Liberia vote?
So according to the American Idol regulation, only people in America are able to vote. But there are also people who have relatives. So if you're in Liberia and if you don't meet the criteria to vote, you can also talk to your family members here and encourage them to be a part of the program to be able to vote.
That was Glendy Reeves, a Liberian and a member of the support group for Samantha Just Sam Diaz, a New Yorker with Liberian roots who was a contestant in the final episode of the American Idol singing competition. Glendy was speaking with us from Virginia. Now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Senegal, where the Senegalese Football Federation has said that the top Senegalese football leagues that have been suspended since March will be decided by playoffs in November. In a first for Africa, the full remaining schedule of 13 games will not be played. Instead, the 14-team League 1 and League 2 will be split and the 7 teams at the top will compete in a mini-league for the title and promotion, whilst the bottom 7 will do likewise for the relegation places. In Ghana, the country's sports ministry is set to take the responsibility of paying Ghana's former national football coach Kwesi Appiah. Kwesi Appiah has for the past few weeks been on a collision course with the Ghana Football Association demanding for his salary arrears. Ghana Football Association admitted that the coach is indeed owed, but was quick to add that it is an obligation of the Ministry of Sport to pay the remuneration of national team coaches. Now, Kofi Asare Braka, the personal assistant to Ghana Sports Minister, has agreed that the Sports Ministry will pay Kwesi Appiah's arrears of $185,000.
For close to about 24 months, we've been constantly paying Kwesi Appiah for 24 months. His contract would have expired in April last year. But at the time we were going to the Nations Cup. So ideally, any person in power at the time, at the FA, could have said that, okay, let me give you 3 months extension.
Meanwhile, CK Akono, the current Black Stars coach, is eager to boost the confidence of local players in the national team when football eventually resumes, especially with the CAF qualification for the Nations Cup.
I want to try as much as I can to not necessarily the gap, but not only, you know, like to at least if we could even have start with 2-3 players who are starting in the first 11, it will be something.
In East Africa, Uganda government is going to conduct a technical needs assessment on the state of its Mandela National Stadium at Namboole, which was recently banned by the Confederation of African Football from hosting international matches pending renovation and upgrading. According to Hamsin Obua, the state minister for sports, the needs assessment will inform the budgeting and planning for upgrading the national stadium to the required standards.
A team of CAF inspectors inspected the stadium in March 2020, and their report came back in April 2020, after government and the ministry had already taken a decision on the plan to renovate and upgrade this stadium.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.